Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, hello there. I'm Nurse Mo, and this is the Straight A Nursing Podcast, where I teach concepts and share tips on how to thrive in nursing school and beyond at the bedside. Pardon my croaky voice today. I have been battling a cough for a few weeks now. I'm finally a lot better, but I still feel like sometimes my voice is a little gravelly. I hope it doesn't take away from the topic we're talking about today, which is air embolisms. Probably one of those things that, especially as a new nurse, terrified me so much. I was always so worried that I was inadvertently going to cause my patient to have an air embolism. So that is what we are talking about today. Before we jump into that, let's take a quick minute for a listener shout out. And this one goes out to Casey, who says, "My nursing program does not have pharmacology or pathophysiology classes. There is a very steep learning curve. Nurse Mo has helped me wrap my head around some pretty complex ideas. Much appreciated." Well, I appreciate you, Casey. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to listen to the podcast and to also share your feedback and that great review. So thank you so very much, and all my best to you as you continue on your journey to become a nurse. Alrighty, so today, as promised, we're talking about air embolisms. And what an air embolism is a rare, thank goodness, but potentially fatal and potentially very devastating event that occurs when a bolus of air enters the vascular space. So there are essentially two types of air embolism: venous air embolism and arterial air embolism. Now, to really understand this concept of air embolisms and the things that go wrong, you need to have a good understanding of cardiopulmonary circulation. So let's take a quick step back to anatomy and physiology and review that pathway. So deoxygenated blood is going to come from venous circulation throughout the entire body and enter the right atrium. From there, it flows into the right ventricle and then out through the pulmonary artery into pulmonary circulation. Now, this is where gas exchange takes place. The red blood cells offload carbon dioxide and they pick up oxygen. So that's that gas exchange that's taking place. And this oxygenated blood then returns to the heart via the pulmonary veins. It enters at the left atrium, flows into the left ventricle, and then is pumped out through the aorta into systemic circulation. So did you get that? If not, again, deoxygenated blood comes from venous circulation throughout the body. It's going to enter into the right atrium, go into the right ventricle, go through the pulmonary artery and into pulmonary circulation where gas exchange occurs. Then the oxygenated blood returns to the heart via the pulmonary veins. It enters at the left atrium, goes into the left ventricle, and then is pumped out through the aorta into systemic circulation. So now let's talk a little bit about the key differences between a venous and arterial air embolism. So first we'll start with venous air embolism. And a venous air embolism occurs when air enters, obviously, venous circulation, and it moves to the right ventricle of the heart, because we're thinking about that pathway, and then into pulmonary circulation where it becomes lodged and essentially wreaks havoc and does the damage that it does. Because it enters pulmonary circulation, you could sometimes see this referred to as a pulmonary air embolism. Just know that that is not the same as a standard pulmonary embolism, which is due to a blood clot. A pulmonary air embolism would be that venous air embolism that has lodged in the pulmonary vasculature. Now, if that air embolism is small, like not a very large amount of air was introduced, it could diffuse into the alveolar space and the patient probably would have minimal to no symptoms. However, larger amounts of air can obstruct pulmonary circulation. It can even lead to obstructive shock and cardiovascular collapse. Now, the bubbles associated with the embolism can be small or large, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the embolism itself was small or large. It's just that the bubbles are small or large. You could have a gajillion tiny bubbles with a large air embolism, okay? So I just wanted to make that clarification. So if the bubbles are tiny little bubbles, they usually obstruct pulmonary microcirculation. And this impairs blood flow. It causes vasoconstriction, which further impairs blood flow. And when this occurs, patients can experience increased pulmonary pressures, increased pulmonary vascular resistance. And what do you think that does to the right side of the heart? It's going to increase pressures in that right ventricle. Ultimately, this patient experiences decreased cardiac output, right ventricular overload, and myocardial ischemia secondary to hypoxia. So again, we've got tiny little air bubbles causing vasoconstriction. They're impeding blood flow through that pulmonary circulation, and patients have increased pulmonary pressures, increased pulmonary vascular resistance. So the right side of the heart is having to work harder. So we've got increased pressure in the right ventricle. This ultimately leads to decreased cardiac output, right ventricular overload, and then the heart is not getting enough cardiac output, not getting enough oxygen delivered to it, myocardial ischemia. Now, larger bubbles of air usually block the pulmonary outflow tract, which really decreases the circulation of blood from that right side of the heart. This leads to increased central venous pressure, decreased pulmonary pressure, and patients can have significant hypotension. Note that if that venous embolism somehow gets across the capillary bed to the arterial side, then the patient could suffer from arterial embolization as a consequence of a venous air embolism. And if this occurs, the patient can essentially have organ ischemia, including cardiac ischemia, if those coronary arteries are affected. So how dangerous the venous air embolism is depends a lot on how much air enters the vascular space. It also depends a lot on how quickly that air enters and, really important, where it lodges. Some studies show that as little as 50 mils of air entering the venous circulation may be fatal. So in addition to the complications that I just mentioned, venous air embolism can also cause pretty significant tissue damage in the lungs themselves. So when we have tissue damage, what happens? We get an inflammatory response. So we get neutrophils coming to that site, platelets, and other inflammatory substances, and they collect in that space where gas exchange should be happening. So gas exchange isn't going to happen if the alveoli are covered in neutrophils and platelets and other inflammatory substances. So patients can experience pulmonary edema. They can experience low oxygen levels. They could even have some pretty significant airway swelling and get increased airway resistance and bronchoconstriction. And then some patients may get very sick and progress to acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. So that's a little bit about venous air embolism. Now let's move over and talk a bit about arterial air embolism. So an arterial air embolism enters, as you may have guessed, arterial circulation and travels to organs and tissues. Really, it can go anywhere throughout the body. If the affected organ or tissue does not have adequate collateral circulation, meaning other vessels that can get oxygen to the tissues, then tissue ischemia and tissue necrosis can result. Now, the two organs most likely to be really detrimentally affected by these little bubbles in the circulation are the brain and the heart, though any organ or tissue can suffer from ischemia. Now, air emboli can occur through direct introduction of air into the arterial site of circulation, such as in trauma or in surgery. It can also occur in patients with a patent foramen ovale, a pulmonary AVM, or in patients with a septal defect. Now, you might be thinking, how much air is going to be really dangerous for an arterial embolism? So the studies suggest that even just 2 mils of air that get into the cerebral arteries and as little as 0.5 mils of air that find their way to coronary circulation can be fatal. And then just like with the venous embolism, you can have that direct tissue damage. You can also get damage from the body's own inflammatory response that ultimately can also lead to organ dysfunction. So we've covered a little overview of venous and arterial air embolisms. Now you're probably thinking, these sound really scary. How do they occur? Because I know you want to be really hyper aware of patients that might be at risk for this rare, but again, potentially fatal complication. So air can enter the vascular space anytime the vasculature is exposed to air or when a pressure gradient exists that allows air to enter circulation as opposed to blood exiting the vessel. So for example, surgery, vascular cannulation, lung biopsies, trauma, and barotrauma that occurs with mechanical ventilation can all cause air embolism to occur. Though rare, thank goodness, some specific procedures that may cause venous air embolism are, again, needle biopsies of lung tissue. I saw that mentioned a lot when I was doing my research. Coronary artery bypass graft surgery, cardiac ablation procedures, total joint arthroplasty, cesarean section, ERCP, and pacemaker placement, and then 2 other very specific types of surgery. And in these 2 types of surgery, we have a very distinct pressure gradient, which again is going to increase the risk for air embolism. And this is neurosurgical procedures and surgeries involving the ear, nose, and throat. And in these procedures, the incision is generally at a location where pressures are higher than central venous pressure. And this pressure gradient makes it easier for air to enter circulation, especially if the patient is in a more upright position. And then I mentioned trauma. So penetrating and blunt trauma to the chest or the abdomen can cause either venous or arterial air embolism as air enters through the wound. Additionally, head and neck injuries specifically have been identified as a risk for arterial air embolism as well. And then barotrauma, which I mentioned briefly, is associated with mechanical ventilation. So barotrauma occurs with that positive pressure ventilation that we use when we are mechanically ventilating our patients. Trauma to the alveoli allow gas to enter pulmonary circulation. Studies show that barotrauma with air embolism is most likely to occur in patients with ARDS and in scuba divers who ascend too quickly. And then another significant, more common everyday risk factor for air embolism is the use of intravenous catheters. So venous air embolism can occur with all kinds of catheters, hemodialysis catheters, central venous catheters, pulmonary artery catheters, It can even occur with power injection of contrast dye. Arterial air embolism is a known risk with arterial catheters, such as those used to monitor blood pressure, and with intra-aortic balloon pumps. So embolisms can occur at the time of catheter insertion, at the time of catheter removal, or even while the catheter is just hanging out in place if the connections are not secure. And we'll talk about safety with these central venous catheters as we get closer to the end of this episode. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and talk about some conditions that put a patient at risk for an air embolism.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Now, conditions which place patients at higher risk for air embolism during insertion are generally those in which central venous pressure is lower than atmospheric pressure. And this can occur when the patient is hypovolemic, okay? Their central venous pressure is going to be lower than normal. It can occur if they take a deep breath during that insertion, or if they are sitting in a semi-upright position or an upright position. Okay, now that I've got you sufficiently freaked out about air embolisms, you probably want to know what the signs and symptoms might be. So the signs and symptoms could be a little bit different depending on if it's venous or arterial. So let's first talk about the signs and symptoms of a venous air embolism. And these can include respiratory symptoms, cardiac symptoms, and neurological symptoms. So on the respiratory side, you're looking at a patient with shortness of breath, with a cough, with tachypnea. Wheezing could be present. Crackles could be present. Their oxygen levels are going to be low. They could even show signs of respiratory failure. And then cardiac symptoms could be things like chest pain, signs of right-sided heart failures like jugular vein distension. Hemodynamic compromise could be present, and that's due to obstructive shock, and the patient could even have cardiac arrest. And then neurological symptoms are things like lightheadedness, loss of consciousness, neurological deficits, and my favorite overall sign that something bad is happening, a sense of impending doom. And if you ever have a patient who says, "I feel like I'm gonna die," that's that sense of impending doom that you learned about in nursing school. Pay very, very close attention to that patient and take their statement very seriously because they could be having a very serious complication. Okay, now what about the signs and symptoms of arterial air embolism? So this is, of course, going to vary depending on which organ is suffering ischemia. And the brain is one that is really commonly affected. So patients with an arterial air embolism affecting the brain could show mental status changes and neurological compromise. In severe cases, patients may become comatose or suffer cardiac arrest. And of course, if other organs are affected, the patient will exhibit signs and symptoms associated with that particular organ. So an example might be the kidneys. If the kidneys are really adversely affected, the patient could have a sudden drop-off in their urine output, for example. Now, before we dive into what we're going to do if we suspect an air embolism, let's first just quickly review what tests might be conducted or ordered if an air embolism is at risk for the patient or suspected for the patient. So a key one is an ABG. An arterial blood gas will show hypercapnia, which is elevated carbon dioxide levels, and hypoxemia, which is a low PaO2 or low oxygen levels in the blood. So an ABG. Another would be an EKG. Patients typically have tachycardia, so you'll see that on the EKG, and they may show changes depending on whether the embolism is arterial or venous. So an arterial embolism may cause T wave changes and ST depression or ST elevation. Secondary to that, myocardial ischemia or myocardial infarction. And then a venous air embolism may cause things like a right bundle branch block and peaked P waves, basically things that show strain on the right side of the heart. End-tidal CO2 is another one, and this will be more maybe of a monitoring device used for a patient at risk for air embolism, and a decrease in that end-tidal CO2 can be associated with the VQ mismatch that occurs with pulmonary air embolism or that venous air embolism that lodges in the lungs. End-tidal CO2 is often used during high-risk surgeries to catch an embolism at the time of the occurrence. Now, if you'd like to review VQ mismatch, go way back in my podcast library to episode 46. Forgive me for not being fabulous at podcasting at that time, but it's a good lesson, a good review of VQ mismatch. And again, that is episode 46. Another type of monitoring device or monitoring test used during high-risk surgical procedures is observation of transcranial blood flow using a transcranial Doppler. And then an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, and this can be utilized to detect air in the heart and the great vessels. It can also detect pulmonary pressures that are elevated and right ventricular enlargement, which again occurs when that right ventricle is under a lot of strain. And then imaging studies. Various imaging studies may be utilized, including chest X-ray, chest CT, a brain CT scan if cerebral embolism is suspected. Maybe the patient gets an abdominal CT scan if we're looking at organs that could be suffering from ischemia. An MRI could be conducted. So you may see varying imaging studies depending on what is going on with the patient and what type of air embolism is suspected and where it is potentially lodging, what signs and symptoms they're showing. And then other studies that could be conducted include a VQ scan or pulmonary angiography. So you could potentially see those tests as well. Okay, so we've talked about a general overview of venous and arterial air embolisms. We've talked about some potential situations that would put the patient at risk for an air embolism, the signs and symptoms, and some common tests that are utilized. Now let's get to the meat of this, and that is, how is a patient with an air embolism managed? So really important to catch these as quickly as you can and intervene quickly and appropriately. So upon suspicion of an air embolism, the research says that the initial key treatments are going to be oxygenation, patient positioning, and then other supportive therapies. And which treatments the patient receives will depend on the severity, the location, and the type of embolism when we're looking at those supportive and other therapies. So let's first talk about oxygenation. Oxygen supplied at high FiO2, so like 100% oxygen, for example, helps the body resorb the air bolus more quickly. So the patient will get high FiO2 oxygen. Some patients may require emergent intubation and mechanical ventilation if they are severely compromised. So that's oxygenation. Next is positioning. So for a venous air embolism, the studies show that the patient should be positioned in the left lateral decubitus position, Trendelenburg position, with the head 15 to 30 degrees lower than the feet, or in left lateral decubitus with the head down. And essentially, all of these positions can trap that air bolus in the right ventricle and prevent it from entering pulmonary circulation and causing all the problems that it can cause. Now, if an air bolus is suspected to be an arterial bolus, studies indicate the preferred positioning is simply a supine position, though I did see some articles that suggested right lateral decubitus or Trendelenburg, but I really like to defer to the online resource UpToDate because I feel like it's the most up-to-date, and that reference said supine position. And the reason the supine position is utilized for arterial embolisms is that arterial blood flow is really strong. It's going to be much stronger than venous blood flow. And those air bubbles can enter circulation even against that gradient that occurs with that Trendelenburg position, that upward battle, right? So because cerebral edema is often a consequence of arterial embolism, the head down position would actually exacerbate that cerebral edema. So that's why the studies kind of indicate a supine position. Now, if your hospital has a protocol for air embolism, you're going to follow your hospital's protocol for how you position and intervene for your patient, of course. Okay, so then we can talk about some supportive therapies, which are going to depend on, again, the severity, location, and type of embolism. So one of those is removing air from the heart. And this isn't super common, but potentially, the physician could remove air from the heart chambers directly by inserting a needle into the heart and aspirating the air out, or through a central venous catheter that is hopefully already in place. It would take quite a bit of time to insert a central venous catheter, or if they have a pulmonary artery catheter in place, they could potentially remove air from the heart in that way. Another supportive therapy that would depend on the severity is chest compressions, which is called closed chest cardiac massage, I believe. So chest compressions could be utilized if no other options are effective, or maybe there's no other options available and the patient is extremely hemodynamically compromised. That forceful compression of the heart may improve cardiac output by kind of pushing that bolus forward out of the pulmonary outflow tract into smaller vessels of the pulmonary vasculature. Of course, then you would have those other problems, but at least you have some cardiac output. Hyperbaric oxygen was mentioned quite a bit in the studies that I've reviewed, and it may be utilized in severe cases, though the drawback to this is that it's not always readily available. There's usually very few locations that have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and the risks associated with transporting the patient may outweigh the potential benefits of that oxygen or that hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Another kind of key intervention is IV fluids. A fluid bolus can increase that central venous pressure, which is going to help further prevent air from entering venous circulation. And then let's say you have a patient who is hemodynamically compromised. You've given them some fluids, but it's not really helping their hemodynamics. Then they may benefit from a vasopressor such as norepinephrine. And then some other specific treatments are going to be aimed at the patient's very specific organ damage complications that they're having. So for example, a patient who suffers from ARDS, from that injury to their lung tissue, will require specific treatment for that condition. And a patient with acute kidney failure due to organ ischemia may need temporary or even permanent dialysis. Okay, so now that you have a really good overview, kind of a basic overview of air embolism, I know you want to prevent them as much as you can. And there's a lot of things that physicians do when they're inserting central venous catheters, for example, or doing certain types of procedures that help to prevent this from occurring. But as a nurse, One of the most important ways you can prevent an air embolism is to manage central lines and arterial lines with unsurpassed diligence. So I've got some tips here for you, and I will list them out. So one of those is to ensure patients are positioned in Trendelenburg when central venous catheters are inserted, especially in that subclavian or the jugular veins. If the femoral vein is being used, the study suggests that a supine position may be utilized. But if the physician comes in and they're going to place a central venous catheter in the IJ, in the internal jugular, and they don't put the patient into Trendelenburg, you 100% can say, would you like this patient in Trendelenburg because the studies show it reduces the risk for air embolism? Pretty sure they're not going to say no. If they do, that's a whole other problem. You can advocate for your patient, though. That is always in your power and your role as a nurse. So Trendelenburg during central venous catheter insertion. And then what about when you're, because you're going to be the one removing the central venous catheter, most likely, if that is part of your hospital policy, protocol, your scope of practice, what have you, placing patients in Trendelenburg when removing central venous catheters from the subclavian or jugular veins can help prevent an air embolism from occurring. And again, the study said supine position may be okay if you're removing from a femoral central venous catheter. And then also, just more along the lines of what you do when you're removing the catheter, you really want to take measures to avoid the patient inhaling during removal, because that would just pull that air right in. So you need to have a patient, hopefully, who is able to follow instructions so that you can teach them what to do. You want to teach them not to inhale, not to cough, and to not speak at all during the removal procedure. And then other things you can do is you can have the patient perform a Valsalva maneuver. That can elevate central venous pressure pretty significantly and is a great option for a cooperative patient. And that Valsalva maneuver is basically that vagal maneuver that you would have your patient do if they were in SVT. Again, it can pretty significantly increase that central venous pressure and help prevent air from entering. Another method is to have the patient take a breath in and then hold their breath. Now, when I was learning about removing central venous catheters, I was taught to have them exhale and hold at the end of the exhale. Well, the challenge and the problem with that is that, and you can try it right now if you want, breathe out, hold your breath out, and then what happens when you need to take a breath in? You immediately take a breath in, right? So that could occur if the removal is shocking to the patient and they startle, they could easily take a breath in. So we don't want that. So I found a resource, a study that suggested that an inhale before you remove, you're not removing yet, you have them take a breath in and hold it, and then you remove quickly. And for example, let's say the patient then feels a need to take a breath. Well, they have to exhale the held air first. Does that make sense? So that is why that method was suggested by this particular study. You also want to make sure that you hold manual pressure after removal for at least 10 minutes. It could be longer to achieve homeostasis. You don't want any bleeding from that site. You want a nice, good seal. You will immediately then apply an occlusive dressing to the site and instruct the patient to keep it in place for 24 hours because there's still kind of a pathway into the vascular space. So you want to make sure that that has time to close up and heal. So keep that occlusive dressing on for 24 hours. Now, as always, you always want to defer or follow your hospital's specific policy, protocol, procedure for removing a central venous catheter. So make sure you look that up and know what that is. Another thing to do is just with your overall management of your central lines, your arterial lines, is keep all your connections very secure. Check them regularly. It's surprising how things can just kind of loosen over time. So as part of your start of shift routine, get in there, check all your connections. I would do it again periodically throughout the day as well, especially after repositioning or if you transport the patient down to a CT scan or something like that. You want to keep all catheters clamped and closed when not in use. And let's say you're going to go and give your patient an IV push medication or a routine saline flush. Make sure you get all the air out of your syringes prior to doing that. And another tip I saw is to place the patient in a supine position when drawing blood or administering those IV push medications through a central venous catheter. Of course, you have to weigh this against the patient's toleration of that. A lot of times when I was working in the ICU, for example, if I had a patient who was on the ventilator, depending on what was going on with them, some patients would not tolerate a supine position. So you have to always weigh, you know, one risk against the other. So there you have it, your briefish overview and foray into air embolisms. I hope I didn't terrify you. I was certainly terrified as a new grad of these. I'm still very wary of them. I always, like, if I have a patient with an arterial line, you better believe I'm looking and always looking for any kind of air bubbles and getting those out of the system before I flush into the patient. And I would say the caution is definitely well deserved because, as you learned in this episode, air embolism, venous or arterial, can have devastating consequences for your patient. So if you want to learn more about central venous catheter management, I do have an episode on that. And that episode dives into preventing central venous catheter infections. And that is episode 285. So not related to air embolism, but if it piqued your interest in managing central lines, then you want to go and check that out. And then next week, I hope to see you back. We're going to dive into pediatrics and talk about pediatric cardiology. And I'm not going to say more than that because I haven't actually put that episode together yet. And I just want to make sure that I've chosen the most interesting pediatric cardiology topic to share with you next week. So to find out what it is, you just have to come back. And if you're subscribed to the show, it will automatically show up for you in your podcast library. Oh, and speaking of podcast libraries, if you're using Google Podcasts, you probably know that it is going away very soon. So this podcast has already been submitted to Amazon Music. You should be able to get it on Amazon Music. If you were using Google Podcasts on your Android device, you can get Amazon Music. It's also on Spotify, which I believe is for both iOS and Android. The beauty of Spotify is that it allows me to create playlists for you. So I actually have all my episodes organized into playlists, like respiratory playlist, new student playlist, organization playlist, cardiac playlist, etc. So that's one of the great things about Spotify. And I'll put a link to that Spotify playlist in the episode notes. Well, that's it for me today. I will see you back here next week. Thanks again for spending your precious free time with me, and I'll see you soon. Bye for now. This podcast is brought to you by Straight A Nursing, a proud member of the Airwave Media Network. For more educational podcasts, check out airwavemedia.com. And for more nursing-related content, go to straightanursingstudent.com.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? We sure have. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, streaming now.